is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a bill to legalize medical marijuana got a hearing in the state capitol this week. We'll talk about the shifting politics of marijuana and efforts to decriminalize weed at the federal level.
First, Republican legislatures across the country, including here in Wisconsin, have introduced over 100 bills that would restrict health care for transgender children and adolescents, including puberty blockers and hormone replacement therapies.
Several states, including Arizona and Alabama, have passed bills into law that would criminalize certain medical treatments for transgender youth.
Medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, have said these bills threaten the health and well-being of transgender children.
We're talking about legislation that would ban medical treatments for transgender youth, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these bans we're seeing around the country? Are you the parent or caregiver of a transgender child? What's your reaction to Wisconsin and other states introducing bills that would ban puberty blockers and hormone therapy? Would this kind of ban affect your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Dr. Joshua Safer is the executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Safer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, happy to be here.
Before we get into the particulars of the bills popping up around the country and the different kinds of treatments, can you talk about the impact on some transgender kids if they don't have access to age-appropriate treatments like these?
Well, the data that we have are for the period when we were not providing care, when we had statistics like 40% of children in these circumstances considering suicide, considering actual suicide attempts, and certainly self-harm.
I looked at guidelines from an endocrinologist association that you're a member of, and I think people sometimes think these kind of treatments are entered into kind of willy-nilly without a lot of thought. Almost every procedure there includes something like, you know, mental health counseling and evaluation before these procedures, these medications, and so forth can move forward. Can you talk about some of the barriers, the steps involved in a lot of these treatments?
I think the first thing that's important to consider when we're thinking about children is prior to puberty, we don't do anything with children other than support them in practical ways and listen to them and work with them. So if someone has a gender identity that's different than the sex that was recorded on the birth certificate than the rest of their biology, then we're talking about wearing certain clothes or wearing a certain haircut, things that are very reversible and where there's plenty of opportunity to think through plans. We follow that at puberty for children who are articulate enough to identify themselves soon enough for us to even act then with puberty blockers, which are, again, a very conservative intervention. It's reversible, essentially, that allows us to be thoughtful and for those kids and their families to interact with the necessary mental health professionals and be methodical and reasoned in their thought process. That's about it for young people, for people who are under age 18, maybe towards later in teenage years, after we've followed these conservative processes, we might consider sex hormones that match gender identity. And there are some elements that are not completely reversible, but it's only after that very long process that I just reviewed.
And I think people, when they think of procedures, they might think of gender reassignment surgeries. If I'm reading guidelines correctly, that doesn't happen until age 18.
For the most part, that's correct. There, the two exceptions for what we would call gender-affirming surgeries would be in the case of chest masculinizing surgeries for the transgender boys, so female to male, where in someone where gender identity is clear, where all of the methodical process has happened, and where all are on board in a supportive way, a chest reconstruction surgery could happen at a younger age, maybe age 16. And then the other exception that's out there is with transgender young women who might want vaginoplasty en route to college or some similar circumstance like that. Again, someone with gender identity well established, with a good conservative approach having been taken for an extended period of time. Sometimes it is convenient for the purposes of perhaps having the parents be the caretakers rather than having this person have a surgery and then go off to college. Depending upon when their birthday is, they might technically have that surgery a little bit before the age of 18. But those are the only two exceptions.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at medical treatments for transgender youth, what is available, what's not available to them. As states around the country take action, bills introduced, executive actions taken by governors limiting, in some cases criminalizing these kind of procedures, you can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, looking at a state like Texas, now this is an executive action suggesting that parents who are seeking out this kind of gender-affirming care should be investigated for child abuse. What is your response to that move in that state? Currently, I believe, blocked by a judge.
I am baffled. I continue to be baffled by attempts to politicize what is medical care. The medical organizations involved are filled with thoughtful, conservative, science-informed people. And the idea that you would target anyone to deny them medical care, and that you would target parents to deny children care, or that you would target medical professionals in order to prevent them from caring for their patients, essentially violating their professional oath, is mysterious to me, to say the least.
I want to look more closely at some of the treatments you mentioned. Puberty blockers, as you said, reversible over time, but any medication is going to come with side effects. Can you weigh the costs and benefits of puberty blockers?
Puberty blockers it's kind of an interesting thing in terms of who were envisioning getting these mm-hmm. puberty blockers. I think the anxiety for many is that there will be children who are not transgender, or maybe they are transgender, but they don't want treatment after all, who will be started on puberty blockers. And for that narrow crowd, the puberty blockers really are reversible. We've been using these medications for decades for children who enter puberty at an age that is early relative to their peers, and where we don't think it's the right time socially. And in those children who would have entered puberty early, where we use these medications, we later, when they are adults — we've been using these medications for decades, so we have adults who've had this experience — we later are not able to find health care concerns attributable to those medications. And so when we say reversible and that these are very safe, it's with enormous confidence.
And you talked about the process that a kid would go through to get these medications. How, before they're prescribed, how do you make sure, as a healthcare professional, how does the system make sure that they are informed, they're consenting, they know as best they can what they're getting into?
The typical process is for the youth, and the parents to go meet with mental health providers, right, for some sort of assessment that this is logical. And remember, these are very safe medications that are reversible. So I'm not too concerned about somebody using these medications for a short time who might be exploring gender identity and then opt out. That really you know, when you talk about risks and benefits, you act like there are major risks. But when you have virtually no risk, and then a significant upside benefit for trans kids, then it's actually an incredibly easy consideration.
Dr. Joshua Safer is with us, executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, talking to us about bills in states around the country that would ban or limit medical treatment for transgender children and adolescents.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or comments about gender-affirming treatment. And if you're a transgender adult, we would love to hear from you. How has transitioning changed your life? How would your life be different if you had been able to transition earlier? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about bills banning health care for trans youth in states around the country. Dr. Joshua Safer stays with us, executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions, maybe your own experiences. What do you think about this wave of laws limiting, banning, in some cases criminalizing gender-affirming care? Is this something that is affecting your own life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. I had a question about gender-affirming surgeries for cis kids or gender-affirming procedures. I'm thinking like breast augmentation or breast reduction, or in some cases I know that maybe children who aren't growing to the height that they want to be, and oftentimes this is like boys and young men receiving growth hormone. I'm just kind of curious like where the laws might fall on that and just kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Angie, thanks for the call. Dr. Safer, is there any overlap in those issues that Angie brought up?
I think those are great. That's a great question, and in a sense, great points. In general, we don't have laws with regard to healthcare. In general, that's the whole point for licensing physicians and other healthcare professionals in order to customize situations to the patient and not have some rule that, let's say, you have to use this insulin for diabetes and not that insulin, or whatever the circumstance might be. And so if we're talking about breast augmentation or breast reduction surgeries for a girl who is under 18, that's really a decision between that child and the parents and the physician. And with gender affirming care, you would think it would be the same thing, and in most places it is, but some of these attempts to politicize this are going against that usual framework. And then same for growth hormone that you mentioned. That's a decision that's internal to a family, parents and their children, and with the counsel of their physicians, so a patient-physician decision. That's why it's so surprising that there is this attempt to separate out gender-affirming care from that usual model.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, you mentioned the politicization of this issue. Florida's health department just issued guidance against gender-affirming care to doctors in that state and accused federal guidance, including the CDC and national healthcare groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, for saying they were politicizing it by their endorsement of these procedures. You've written and tweeted in the opposite direction that these bans are unnecessarily politicizing. How do you weigh the political back and forth on this?
Well, within medicine, there is no political back and forth. that is the Endocrine Society, which is the 18,000 person organization of endocrinologists internationally, based in Washington, D.C., or bigger yet, the American College of Physicians, or bigger yet, the AMA, are all on the same page on this subject. which is we're data-driven. We do experiments to see what's best. We follow the data and we make the judgments with regard to what's best in terms of medical care across the entire spectrum of medical care. Gender-affirming care fits in that framework. And so unless you want to view all of medicine, all of organized medicine as being on some side of a political argument, then there is no political argument. And like you've heard me say, it's a mystery to me. That is, medical people do not all share the same politics. If you want to go to a meeting of the AMA or of the Endocrine Society and discuss some of the other issues that we debate in society, you will find people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats and people who are conservative and people who are liberal and so on. But we won't debate that. We use science to inform us for our treatment decisions. And that is true for gender affirming care also.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at gender affirming care for teens in particular, as states around the country pass or attempt to pass laws against that kind of care. We had a comment through our Wisconsin project. Our writer says, I do not have trans kids. I am the trans person in my family. They go on, at 61, I have yet to receive any more than hormones, though I've pushed for more extensive options with Medicaid. My health care has been interrupted by transphobic providers. My peers have gotten the services I desire long ago, and I feel left behind and regarded as worthless. So our listener looks back on a life of not having received that care. Not an uncommon story, I'm guessing, Dr. Safer.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that story, but you are right. It used to be even a more common story because we weren't providing the care that we needed to be providing. There's been a shift in the establishment medical world in terms of our understanding of gender identity as a biological phenomenon, as for all intents and purposes, part of biological sex. And that has resulted in a shift in our entire approach to care, where we have been able to do better by our patients than we had in the past.
There are probably people listening and people participating in this debate who don't believe that's a thing, that there are only men and there are women, and they don't acknowledge a category aside from that, in between it, wherever on the map. What would you say to them in particular?
Well, our understanding of the complexity of sex or biological sex, and I'm using those words to mean all of that biology that is part of reproduction, our understanding of that complexity has evolved over the years. So once upon a time, we thought it related just to body parts, to anatomy. Then we understood more. We understood chromosomes. We understood genes. And right now in 2022, the model probably has about six categories of components that in order to have reproduction, you know what sex you are, you know your choice of partners, you have certain body parts, you have certain gametes, cells, that is sperm or eggs that can mix for that reproduction. And for most of the population, those are all aligned in a certain way. But we know that each of those pieces is coded by different genes, and people can have some of those genes not aligned with others. We can see it physically in some people. And with regard to gender identity, we couldn't see it, which is why we're late in discovering it. But we certainly can ascertain that to be true. And that's all transgender people are, as a person with that particular circumstance.
Time for one more caller. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hello.
Hi. I've been very distressed ever since this news came out from the governor of Texas. It seems to me that given the emotional and mental distress that it causes, that it will cause children and adolescents, transgender children and adolescents, if they are denied the medical treatment that they need in order to be at home in their own bodies and their own identity. It seems to me that the governor and any other politicians who propose and who put forward and who pass this kind of legislation that will that would deny these children and prosecute their parents, it seems to me that the child abusers are the governor of Texas and the politicians who put forth and passed this kind of legislation.
Stella, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left. Dr. Safer, can you talk about the impact on these kids, these adolescents that Stella is worried about?
Well, I share her fear. I share Stella's fear. And I only wish that these politicians that would look to the medical community to inform them in medical care. Texas has great medical institutions. Baylor, University of Texas, Florida, the same. It's not like they need to go to other states even to find experts in care who could help them inform their decisions and make them medical and science-based.
Dr. Safer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He talked to us today about bills in states around the country, including some here in Wisconsin, that are aimed at banning medical treatments for transgender youth.
Coming up after the news, a cannabis policy expert joins the show to talk about an effort to legalize medicinal use of marijuana here in Wisconsin. We'll also look at how the state's marijuana laws compare to others around the country. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Follow these conversations whenever and wherever you are, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming, archives, news, and more. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter.
Mining company has the go-ahead to do some exploratory drilling for copper and gold in northern Wisconsin. We'll get two perspectives on the potential for a new mining operation here in the state.
Now, a bill that would legalize medical marijuana in Wisconsin got a hearing in the state legislature this week. Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski is the bill's sponsor.
Don't see that it's government's role to stand between me or you, and a natural product with less side effects than some of the prescription drugs that we had.
The legislature's session is over, so the bill won't get a vote this year. And even though surveys show strong bipartisan support in the state for legalizing medical marijuana, it's not clear if enough state lawmakers feel the same.
We're talking about Wisconsin's approach to marijuana and how it compares to other states and what's happening at the federal level.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see medical marijuana legalized at the state level? How about recreational marijuana? Should the federal government make those things legal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Alex Kreit is an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There has been a pretty big shift in marijuana in the U.S. on the state level during the last decade or so. How out of step or in step is Wisconsin with how other states are handling marijuana right now?
Wisconsin's pretty out of step at this point in not having a comprehensive medical cannabis law. 37 states have that already, and you know, including a lot of much more conservative states. States that are much more conservative than Wisconsin, and you've got 18 states that have legalized all adult use recreational legalization. So you know, Wisconsin's getting to be in a pretty distinct minority and not having a comprehensive medical cannabis law at this point.
Now, this latest bill here to legalize medicinal marijuana is authored by a Republican. That said, it's still considered a pretty heavy lift to get this through our Republican-controlled legislature, and it sounds like, from what you just said, Alex, there have been Republican majorities in other states that have gone ahead with some kind of legalization?
Yep. Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, are all states where you've had legalization passed through the state legislature. In Mississippi, I believe it was following a ballot measure that was struck down, but then went successfully through the legislature recently. So, yeah, you've had this passed with success in pretty conservative states through the state legislature, and of course, in states that have the ballot initiative process, that's a whole different circumstance because it can be put directly before the voters. But you've also had states with ballot measures that are conservative states, like Montana, where it's passed by ballot initiative. But even in states without the initiative process, there have been some pretty deeply conservative states where medical marijuana has passed through the state legislature.
We've also seen a fairly big shift in the public support for legalization. Here in Wisconsin, surveys have showed more than 60% of people support legalizing recreational pot. And a few years ago, a survey showed 83% supported medical marijuana. What do you think has driven that growth in public support for legal marijuana?
I think really probably the biggest thing is just people seeing how it's played out in the states that have legalized it recreationally. I mean, I think you've had for quite some time, really, a supermajority level support for medical marijuana. The polling for that has been really, in the, 70s plus nationwide since, the early to mid 2000s. So I think that for medical, that's had really this kind of level or close to this level of support for a while. And for recreational marijuana, I think that's something where people really have seen as, the legalization states, legalization has played out in the states that have legalized it. I think more and more people are looking at it and saying, the sky hasn't fallen. People who were maybe skeptical of it or who were opposed to it but not strongly so are looking at how it's playing out in those states and saying, hey, this isn't maybe as bad as I feared that it was going to be. There are some pluses to this, and I think that that's really swaying public opinion.
And in those states where we do see legalized medicinal marijuana, what kind of restrictions come with those laws? What is the process to obtain medical marijuana if it is legal?
Yeah, it varies, state by state. Certainly there's a pretty big degree of variation as to how restrictive each state is. But generally, of course, the big thing that every state's going to require for medical marijuana is going to be a doctor's recommendation. And it's a recommendation, not a prescription, because it's still illegal federally. And, so it doesn't have the same, it's not sort of the same process that you would have for a prescription for an FDA approved product. But, a similar type of thing, going to see a doctor and getting a recommendation. A lot of states have restrictions, or some states, I should say, have restrictions on what it can be recommended for, and they might have a list of particular ailments and say that it can't be recommended for anything other than that. Some states are a little bit more open-ended and leave it to the doctor's judgment in that regard. So you've got sort of those kinds of rules and regulations and restrictions in terms of who can access it. And then, of course, there's the whole world of regulatory oversight of the manufacturing, the sales process, rules about testing the product to make sure there's, no impurities and all that sort of thing.
We're talking with Alex Kreit right now, assistant professor of law and an expert in cannabis law and policy at Northern Kentucky University, looking at how Wisconsin compares to the rest of the country when it comes to marijuana after a hearing on a bill to legalize medicinal pot in the state capitol yesterday. Alex, Wisconsin is bordered by Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois, three states that have legalized marijuana to some extent. And I know you've looked at situations like this. When there is a state like Wisconsin that's a bit of an island, what effect do we see or not see from other states that have some version of legal pot?
I don't think that there's a huge effect on use, but it certainly puts the states, that don't have legal marijuana kind of in a circumstance where they're missing out on the potential for tax revenue. And I mean, I think that the reason that there's probably not, an indication of a significant impact on use is that, marijuana, even when it is illegal, is pretty accessible and available. I mean, and then frankly, is I think one of the things that, proponents of legalization cite to and that people look at and say this is, a reason why maybe prohibition hasn't worked and it's time to consider legalization, is that even with, prohibition, even with the war on marijuana, it's not that difficult for people to get marijuana in a state where it's completely prohibited. So certainly in, states like Wisconsin where it's prohibited, for people who live close to the border to a legalization state, somebody who lives close to Illinois, they might decide to drive across the border to Illinois and buy it there, and perhaps, people who maybe were buying it before from illegal dealers in Wisconsin might do that, or some people who, might not otherwise use it might decide to drive across the border and get some for personal use. But I don't think there's been a significant impact in terms of sort of overall availability of marijuana in states where it's illegal, just because they're bordering states where it's now made legal. The reality is it's already very available, and it has been for, pretty much the entirety of marijuana prohibition. So I don't think that it's made it more available per se, but it has made it a little bit more convenient maybe for people who, might want to drive across and get it from a regulated store across the border in Illinois.
Sure. I want to take a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have John in Sauk City with us. Hey, John.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What was on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I was, I just kind of had to write this down so I can focus my thoughts here. But my idea was, I was wondering if there was, if your guest knew anything about licensing of cannabis. And, particularly for, like, small farmers. And the concept is that I'd like to present is, how do we prevent, I hate to say big business, but how can we prevent big business from owning the licenses for growing cannabis?
Sure. John, thanks for the call. Oh, and I want to throw that to Alex. This is not an issue here in Wisconsin at this time, but other states, I'd imagine, have had to talk about things like who gets to farm cannabis, who gets to sell it and distribute it. How have they gone about answering those questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen a range of approaches, and a lot of it really depends on, to what extent the state wants to try to, kind of have it be as much of a kind of open-ended free market thing, versus trying to encourage or have a market where small businesses can thrive. And that, I think, certainly is in small farms in the case of manufacturers. There, I think, are ways that you can try to structure the regulatory regime to do that. Things like rules surrounding how many licenses any one entity or group can hold at one time, the size of the farm or the manufacturing operation for each licensee. So there's, a range of sort of regulatory tools that states can and have used to try to address that issue. And certainly, I think, in some states, there has been, that kind of effort to prevent, the corporatization of the marketplace or the total corporatization or takeover of the marketplace. And again, it's a range of approaches. Some places, might have a regulatory structure that allows for those large-scale enterprises, but also has regulations and licenses in place that would try to encourage and facilitate, craft cannabis, if you will, sort of maybe similar to a craft beer maker versus, the large conglomerates. So, we've really seen a range of approaches to that.
We're talking to Alex Kreit. He's an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. With us today to talk about an effort in Wisconsin to legalize medical marijuana and how Wisconsin's approach to marijuana compares to states around the country.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see marijuana legalized for medical use, for recreational use in Wisconsin? Are you in one of our neighboring states that has one of those laws in place? How are things working out in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation and maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
Dean Knetter. We're talking about marijuana policy in Wisconsin and across the country. A bill to legalize medicinal use in Wisconsin got a hearing in the state legislature this week. Alex Kreit from Northern Kentucky University stays with us.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a medical marijuana law pass here in Wisconsin? How about recreational marijuana? What questions, what thoughts do you have on the issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll go back to our callers now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hey, great to hear this program. Yes, I would fully support this bill. I would like to borrow your microphone to speak to the Republicans in the state legislature on this, because a few of them are quite uninformed. On this very show, I heard one Republican congressman on this subject last year spout a bunch of scientific misinformation and gobbledygook, called his office, asked them to send me the study he cited that, you know, marijuana causes addiction, and it is a gateway drug, which is all untrue, and couldn't get a call back, never heard anything. But it was on this show that I heard this first being debated last year. So I think the Republicans in the state need to be educated. They need to educate their fellow Republicans and get this done, because two-thirds of the country want these laws passed. And these days, two-thirds of the people can't get together on anything, but they've gotten together on this.
Gotcha. Martha,
thank
you for the call, Martha. Alex, we mentioned earlier that public opinion is pretty strong in support of legalizing marijuana to some extent. But in Wisconsin and some other states, the politics haven't kept up with that. In those instances, are there misconceptions out there that you see a lot of that you think could use some correcting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, maybe a big, you know, part of it certainly is sort of the long memory maybe some politicians have for the anti-drug sort of drug war era. You know, certainly any politicians who kind of came of age politically in the 80s and 90s, and even to a lesser extent, you know, the early 2000s, they, you know, I think maybe are much more of the mindset of the war on drugs having, you know, strong, resolute political support. And even though the, you know, sort of lay of the land has shifted dramatically, I think there's a contingent of politicians who are kind of still maybe stuck in that mindset, or concerned that this is, you know, even if the polls say that people support it, that it's not as popular as the polls say for X or Y reason. And so I think there's that, you know, component of it, certainly. And I think that, you know, for medical cannabis, I think that there are, you know, something I've seen, you know, people say, well, unless and until the FDA approves this, you know, but the reality is that there has, you know, research into the medicinal uses of marijuana has been stifled for a long time because of the federal prohibition. There have been efforts to, you know, increase research, but that's sort of one of the reasons that states have led the way in enacting medical cannabis laws. And, you know, some of the medical uses, I think, are, you know, just kind of, I mean, common sense in a way. I mean, the chief one to help with nausea, I joke to my students when I teach my drug law class, you know, do how many studies do we really need to know that marijuana can make you hungry, right? I mean, for, you know, in a way, obviously, if you're just a recreational user, you know, smoking some marijuana and eating some more chips, it can be a funny thing. But of course, if you, you know, are undergoing chemotherapy, it's a real legitimate medical use to have something that can help stimulate appetite. And so I think there's kind of a misconception that, well, it's not FDA approved, and so states can't move on this issue. But, you know, of course, we have 37 states that have already done that, and that's helping to, I think, encourage the prospect of federal reform and more research that is federally authorized.
And just this month, a bill to decriminalize marijuana on the federal level did pass the U.S. House. A couple Republican votes, I believe, in support of it. That is still awaiting a vote in the Senate, where it would need 60 votes to pass. But Alex, can you give us a sense of what this federal bill would and wouldn't do?
Yeah, so the bill that passed in the House is the MORE Act, and there's a similar measure that's going to be introduced, it looks like right now in August, by Chuck Schumer and some other senators in the Senate. And so, you know, the MORE Act would legalize marijuana federally. It wouldn't supersede state law. So states that have prohibitions, those would remain in place at the state level. But of course, I think if federal law were to change, that might encourage some states that currently have prohibition and are on the fence to rethink it. But it would legalize marijuana federally. It would tax marijuana federally. It would start at a 5% tax under the MORE Act, that, you know, that which is the one that passed the House again. It would expunge nonviolent federal marijuana convictions and would have some incentives for states to expunge marijuana convictions at the state level. And there would also be some provisions for social equity to try to help small businesses, to try to help people who might want to get in the marijuana business who've been negatively impacted by the war on drugs, that sort of thing. So it's a pretty comprehensive proposal. And even though, you know, like you, as you said, it got a couple of Republican votes, there's actually a competing in the House legalization proposal that is being has been put forward chiefly by Republicans. So even though the MORE Act itself only got a few Republican votes, that I think kind of undersells a little bit the amount of support for the idea of federal reform in the House among Republicans. There's a pretty significant contingent of Republicans who didn't vote for the MORE Act but support a competing measure. So I think there's really starting to be some real movement there at the federal level, but you know that the Senate is probably going to be the hardest lift because of the issue of the filibuster and the need to get 60 votes there for something pass.
Time for one more caller. We have Pam in Southwest Wisconsin. Hey, Pam.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Yeah. I had a quick question because I know CBD is not the same as marijuana at all, but we have some CBD stores here in Wisconsin, and I noticed they'll say, oh, you know, this is the legal kind. It's Delta 8 and Delta 10, not Delta 9 or whatever. But they have THC signs, and when you read the ingredients, it says THC. And so I'm just sort of curious, like, how they can get by, which is great because it's a helpful product. But how is it they're able to get through? Is it because even if they have some component of THC?
Sure. Pam, thanks for the question. Alex, how are we drawing the line between when it comes to THC content?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that's where there's actually, I think, a fair amount of uncertainty currently in the law on a component of it. So under state law, Wisconsin does have a CBD-only law. There's only three states that have no medical cannabis law whatsoever. So Wisconsin's in the group of, I think it's 10, that has a CBD-only law. Then with respect to the kind of question of the ones that are advertising that it's CBD only, but it has, you know, some sort of THC type of component to it. There's under federal law, at the federal level, there was a hemp legalization bill. And there's kind of currently some uncertainty in the law as to whether you can take extracts of hemp products that might have mind-altering effects and whether that would still be legal under this federal hemp bill. And it's something that, again, frankly, the law is kind of unsettled. And the places that are selling these kind of products are operating in kind of a legal gray area apart from any of the entities that are doing it, you know, kind of in full compliance with the Wisconsin CBD-only medical law.
Got it. Pam, thank you for the call. And Alex, we are just about out of time today, but I want to thank you for your time and joining us and helping us understand what's going on around the country. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Alex Kreit is an assistant professor of law and the director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He was with us today to talk about Wisconsin's approach to marijuana policy and what's going on in other states and on the federal level.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the state Supreme Court has approved Republican-drawn electoral maps in its latest ruling on redistricting. We'll look at what those new maps mean for elections coming up later this year and who you end up seeing on your ballot and what it means for politics and policy in the years to come. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Tomorrow's Friday on Central Time. It means Food Friday. We'll talk with the author of a new cookbook on brownies, the regular kind. Dean and I both have some experience baking brownies with varying results. Dean, how is your brownie game?
It is a work in progress, Rob. I feel pretty good on the basics, getting that balance of firmness and fudginess. But when you add in any extras, peanut butter, cream cheese, which can be really good, I'm still a little bit clueless there, so I'm hoping to pick up some tips.
Yeah, I've done, you know, box mix brownies. I've done some from scratch ones, some pretty straight ahead fudgy brownies. I really like when you're at places you can get those cream cheese guys.
Oh, yeah.
But I've never tried it myself. So maybe this week you brought in some brownies today.
I did in anticipation
Thank
of
you.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
I'm pretty full though. So they were good though. So it was worth it. Food Friday, brownies coming up tomorrow. You're listening to Central Time. Give us your brownie secrets, by the way, at centraltime@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network.